struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Ah, yes. Thursdays always feel good, don't they? It's like, yeah, you know, I got another day left in a week, but the bulk of it is behind us. And no matter how bad your week is, it's almost over, right? Hey, good morning. It's Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Hope you're doing well. I think you're going to really, really enjoy today's show. We have two phenomenal guests. First, you're going to meet Susan Bahari. And Susan has something very, very special happening this Saturday, October 17th. It's the first monument in the nation's capital honoring all women of the military at the Women's Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery. And Susan's the artist. Her statue has been chosen. And it's called The Pledge, which honors the commitment of all our brave servicewomen past and present. And what a vital time for this to be taking place. I just love every aspect of this story. And she's a dynamite person. We're going to meet her in just a few minutes. We're also going to meet Jane Ward. Jane has an incredible new book out called The Tragedy of Heterosexuality. What, you're saying? Is it hard being heterosexual? You thought it was hard being gay, right? Well, I've read about and talked about with this with my gay friends about the complexities of being gay. And it certainly is extremely arduous compared to, well, I think it is compared to being heterosexual. Well, I guess before delving into this conversation with Jane, I would always say to my kids, I just want you to have a life that's going to be as problem-free as possible. You're going to have millions of problems throughout your life. But certain things we have control over. Certain things we don't. Do we control our sexuality? No. We can certainly control who we date, but we can't control who we're attracted to. So Jane Ward, who's a professor of gender and sexuality studies at University of California, as I just mentioned, and has authored two previous books, Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men, great title, and another book, Respectably Queer, Diversity, Culture, and LGBT Activist Organizations. She has walked the walk and talked the talk, and she's going to give us a lot of insight on this really, really compelling topic, because if you think about it, how easy do we have it, heterosexuals? Is it easy trying to live the nuclear dream, reality, expectations of being in the 21st century, 2020, dating, courting, meeting the right person or not meeting the right person because you're just going to settle? And we know so many people, right, that have settled with the wrong person, and they just settle for a life of misery or decide to bail out, even if it's after, you know, a couple of kids. But we'll get to Jane Ward's conversation. But I certainly want to touch on a few pressing things. And I'm even so tired of saying it and even hearing the name Trump. But today really irked me, actually yesterday rather, when, of course, everything that comes out of his mouth pretty much is a lie or incorrect facts. And the fact that he is trying to put a spin on the fact that Osama bin Laden is still alive is just abysmal. I don't understand how he comes up with these ways to just detract from other aspects, Corona, COVID-19. And to say that the previous administration had this whole ploy that the Navy SEALs did not actually kill Osama bin Laden. And last night on CNN, Chris Cuomo show, he had actually the Navy SEAL that apparently was the trigger man that actually took down, or one of the trigger men that took down Osama bin Laden. And he, Chris actually set up this segment very well, saying, hey, he's not a Democrat, he's not a Biden fan, but he's here to set the record straight. And can you imagine being a Navy SEAL, as this gentleman stated in the interview, as he said that, you know, we all kissed our families, our kids and wives and husbands goodbye because we didn't think we were going to return. Can you imagine that, having a job where you're walking out the front door thinking, wow, this could be it. Most likely, this is it. And sure enough, that's what they do for a living. Anyway, so they had this mission, and he said, yeah, we got Osama bin Laden. As a matter of fact, he said President Obama didn't want to make any announcements until the DNA test was conclusive that it was Osama bin Laden. And that's what they did, because it took extra time to have, I think, a second or third redundant test just to confirm it actually was. And he went into a little bit of graphic detail about knowing exactly how it was when he was there on site. But it's just unfathomable that Trump would come up with some spin of this magnitude that really undermines our military. And I know some of the military certainly are not fans of Trump, especially when he doesn't even stand up for when there's a bounty put on our military service men and service women's heads. I mean, that's just unforgivable. We know he's weak. We know he's a coward. We know he's many, many things. And certainly, first and foremost, an incapable leader. And this travesty just undermines our military, our competence, and everything that goes along with it. I never doubted in my mind that Osama bin Laden wasn't murdered. I don't think many, many people in this world on planet Earth have spent any time plotting that idea. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even just the United States that had a iron in a fire here, because when they took down the World Trade Center, there were people from 80 different countries, I believe, 80 different countries. And when the brave men and women on that airplane in Pennsylvania made the decision to take down that plane to save all the people in D.C., which is actually kind of ironic because they made the first decision to save the people in D.C. who make decisions. So going back to the main theme and point of this is that I just cannot believe that Donald Trump has sunk so low to say that the Navy SEALs did not actually take out Osama bin Laden. Not going to waste any more time on this. It's complete fiction. You know what really struck me weird yesterday, and I'm sure it probably struck you weird as well, is that his son, President Trump's son, Barron, tested positive. And he didn't say, my son, Barron, my son, my son, my son. He keeps saying Barron Trump, Barron Trump, Barron Trump, like it's his, I don't know, brother, cousin, stepbrother. It's so bizarre. Wouldn't you think he would have referred to his own flesh and blood as his son? And that got me thinking, is it really his son? Hey, I don't want to like create controversy, but when you hear someone, like if I talk about my son, I wouldn't say, his name isn't John, but I wouldn't say John Farrell, John Farrell. I'd say my son, John, or my son, my son. But for him to say Barron Trump, Barron Trump, just very, very odd. And what else is coming out of the news from the White House? So apparently one of Melania's former friends for a long, long time had, I guess, like an aide job from 2016 to 2017, and I guess signed a lot of confidentiality agreements, but not a personal one. It was only, I think, related to work. Anyway, she has a book out, and apparently Melania is just furious about this, but more so, Trump is throwing every possible lawsuit in the world under the sun at her. So she can say that, the credibility of this book is not accurate, et cetera, et cetera. You know how Trump is. He just throws mud on everything just to fan the flames and to redirect. And speaking of redirecting, you would think at this point, when we have over 215,000 deaths on his watch, the only thing he would be concerned about, the only thing, not his election, two things should be on his front of mind. The health and welfare of his family, because obviously he got ill because of his lack of being careful and thorough, and his family's. And even first and foremost, the health and welfare of his country, this country, the United States. But it's not. It's all about getting to a rally, getting out there in front of as many people as he can. And have you seen some of the interviews and read some of the interviews about people who are attending these rallies? They are so drinking the Kool-Aid. And some of them have said, yes, if Trump said wear a mask, I would definitely put a mask on. So he has the power. I don't know why. I don't know how, because he's very cult-like and he's got these followers. They're sheep that say, yeah, I would do this. And, you know, it's funny when questioned, some of the attendees say, yeah, you know, I think he's just incredible because of what he's done for the economy. And when questioned further, this one gentleman said, well, I'm having the best year ever in the last 10 years. And the interviewer said, well, what do you do for a living? He goes, I'm a debt collector. Well, of course, he's having a banner year. People are going bankrupt. People are running out of money as we speak, by the day, by the hour. It's a really, really horrific situation. And it's funny because, you know, every day, I'm a total optimist, as you guys know by listening to the show. But every day I wake up very positive. My kids are positive, raising positive kids, and that's a great thing. And they're well-informed. They actually watch the debates. They want to watch the debates. They want to be informed. And certainly I don't allow them to be privy to all the things in the news because an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old shouldn't have to have things like that weigh on their mind. But I fill them in on, you know, all the important aspects. And of course, you know, they're not a Trump fan because their parents aren't a Trump fan. And I wouldn't think that an 8-year-old and 11-year-old would have their own opinions separate from their parents at such a young age. And I tell them, as you get older, you may disagree with me. And that's great because we should have logical debates, stimulating conversations about, you know, why things happen a certain way and maybe how change is possible and how it can happen. But any day, every day that I wake up, you know, we all go through our normal parts of the day and routine and work and or trying to find work because so many people are out of work and worries and concerns. But then you think about, you know, when I'm putting my kids on a bus, only the 2 days out of the 5 that they go to school for a half a day because they can't have lunch in school. And I think about how different their worlds are. I'm not talking about my world. I'll deal with myself. Me and my wife will survive. We're doing all right. But the kids, if they're not in private schools, which most kids are not, how could you? They're really suffering educationally, socialization-wise. I mean, my kids tell me that, you know, there's maybe 5 or 7 kids in the classroom with them, and there's hardly any other talk because they're actually on their computer, which I think is just crazy. They're on their computer the whole time inside the classroom while the teacher pretty much caters to the people who are home because it's a split class, A and B. So half the class is in or a portion of the class, whoever opted to be in, and then they have a B program and they're off the other days. So when my kids are home, the other half of the class is in, cohorts. And then on Wednesdays, it's called asynchronous. So everybody's home so they can clean the school dutifully. And I understand that. But the thing is that kids, and of course, I'm not minimizing the death of the 215,000 people, but in terms of a day-to-day, where and how is this thing going to end? The kids are really getting the short end of the stick. It's a shame. And I really, really hope that when Biden becomes the next president, please, 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 we can't have it any other way, that things get turned around on track. There's a uniform national mask wearing policy so we can wear a mask for who knows, 4, 6, 8 weeks and nip this in the bud. We have to get this under control. If you look at the map, there are no green states. No one is safe. The cases are rising daily. And this isn't about fear. This is about reality, man. And I'm just so sick and tired of even some people saying, I'm sick and tired of dealing with this. Well, no shit. Who isn't? But what's the alternative? Be completely lackadaisical and let this invisible virus just wreak havoc over hundreds of thousands of more people until finally you wake up and say, oh, okay, I guess we should have more precautions, more PPE, more social distancing, more overall carefulness. I mean, come on, guys. It's 2020. I thought we were such more of an evolved country. I mean, we're a laughingstock to so many different countries across the globe. It's not even funny. The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. On the Progressive Radio Network, when we return, Susan Bahari, the internationally acclaimed sculptor, and she's going to tell us about what she's unveiling Saturday, October 17th, south of New York City in Arlington, right after this.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you to listen to Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we're doing the best we can for the veterans of our nation. Warrior Connection is an ongoing discussion with veterans, scientists, politicians, journalists, reporters, and doctors about the health and environmental effects of war on our nation's veterans. Our purpose is to provide the information necessary for all veterans to lead a productive life. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
Talk with Mark now. Call 888-874-4888. Insight on the Progressive Radio Network.
All right, well, here we are. But I have to say, what a gorgeous day it is in New York. And I'm hoping wherever you're listening today, it's absolutely as gorgeous there as well. Anyway, my name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Really psyched to have you along. And I'm so psyched to welcome my first guest. I mean, I love artists of all kinds, especially when they create something that impacts society. And Susan Bahari is an incredible person, internationally acclaimed sculptor, artist, and she's unveiling a life-size bronze monument titled The Pledge at the permanent collection of the Women's Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery. And that's happening this Saturday at 2 o'clock. And I am really thinking about packing up the car with the family, Susan, and joining you for this great event.
Thank you so much. Well, I'll tell you something. I'm very honored that you said that you would do that or consider that. It is a private event on Saturday, but on Sunday it is open to the public and people can get tickets from the Women in Military Service for America, the Women's Memorial website.
So this is such a paramount year because it's the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. So I'm sure this is no coincidence in the planning.
No, we felt that it was very important.
And how long have you been working on this, Susan?
Well, it's been over a year for sure, because I was commissioned by the United States War Dogs Association. Mm-hmm. They wanted to honor our female military working dog handlers, as well as all our female military personnel. And so they asked me to create something that would really show the bond and could be any woman. And I wanted it to speak to just, all women of the military. And it's called The Pledge because it's their pledge to honor and protect our country. And also the pledge to each other, the military working dog handler and her dog. It was gifted by the United States War Dogs Association to the Women's Memorial, and they were thrilled to have it.
So would this number be somewhere around the 3 million mark to represent the women past and present who've served for the nation?
Yes, that's correct. And I know the Women's Memorial really wants anyone who's served or has anyone in their family that served to register with them, because they are the major repository for so much information. But as an artist, it's just been an incredible experience. It's such a great honor to do this. I mean, I've dedicated most of my artistic life to this area because I was so early inspired when I did our country's first war dog memorial, Always Faithful, 94.
And
they created
gorgeous,
that trajectory.
Gorgeous monument.
Thank you.
What was your inspiration back then? I mean, obviously you love animals because you love the connection between mankind and animals, but talk about that original and first inspiration.
Well, I used to actually show dogs when I was a teenager and really learned about the connection and how animals should look and training them and all of that. And I loved art. And so this was the perfect melding. But when I got the commission to do the first war dog memorial, Always Faithful, then I was able to really meet people for the first time who serve and see what they're made of and be so impressed by how humble they are. They want to do so much for others and they risk their lives doing it, as do their dogs and their animals who serve. So that's been incredibly inspiring to me. And it's moved me forward to all the work that I've subsequently done in the U.S. for military, for law enforcement, and just in other countries as well, such as Australia, New Zealand, and France. Very incredible experiences, always very incredible people sharing the same, great honor and service. So I hope to do justice to who they are. And
oh, absolutely. You certainly have done beyond justice. Now, is Always Faithful still located in Guam?
Yes, the original casting is at the War Dog Cemetery on the U.S. Naval Base in Guam. They saved so many lives in World War II. And then subsequent castings are located at very special places around the country. Like the museum, the National Museum of the Marine Corps, and universities such as Auburn and University of Tennessee. And in New York at the American Kennel Club Museum of the Dog, you can actually see Always Faithful there.
Fantastic. I'm sure you know many, many women who have served, who are serving. And what does this represent for them?
Well, I think it's such a long overdue recognition. I mean, this is the first monument in our nation's capital to honor all women of the military, past, present, and future.
That's hard to believe, isn't it?
It is hard to believe, but we're doing it now, and it's a celebration of their great, it's honoring them. It's a celebration of all they do, their sense of duty, their great ability, and their compassion as well.
And I love the fact that it's actually positioned right at the gate.
Yes, the Women's Memorial itself is the original gateway to Arlington National Cemetery. It's a
stunning,
beautiful building. It's a curved building, but you wouldn't always know that the Women's Memorial was in that structure, which was the actual original retaining wall and beautiful structure for Arlington. So it does exist since the mid-90s, and it's a great place to go. And certainly to visit Arlington and go inside the Women's Memorial. And in the lobby, you'll see the Pledge Monument.
Susan, I'm sure it sounds strange to some people to say that one of my favorite or our favorite destinations in D.C., even though I still call Arlington, D.C. because it's a stone's throw from the Lincoln Memorial, is a graveyard, but it's absolutely gorgeous. And I think it's so emblematic of our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of the most prominent place to honor those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. But it's such a stunning place to go. And Washington, D.C. is amazing anyway. But as you drive down Memorial Drive and you find all these monuments alongside the road and you go to the end, that's where you're greeted by the Women's Memorial and Arlington National Cemetery. And so it's just been humbling and just been an incredible honor for me to have this happen. And I the women really, really deserve it. And the depiction I've done of the female military working dog handler and her dog is really one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous jobs a woman can do. They're out front in the military, they're out front with their dogs, and they're guiding the way for the safety of the others. And so by having it there at Arlington, having it there at the Women's Memorial, I hope it will help bring that, even put a spotlight on the incredible service and sacrifice of our women in the military.
Absolutely. And I would beg to agree, actually, and expand upon the fact that women are on the front platforms across the gamut. In the war zone, in the peace zone, in the home front, in the professional front, at all levels. And it's so paramount that not only is it coinciding with the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, but in terms of the confusing and or arduous conflicting times that we live in right now, I think it's ideal. I think it's beautifully done. I think that they couldn't have gone to a better sculptor. And the fact that it's life size really gives it a feeling of enormity.
Oh, well, thank you. It's on a base that describes, it's on a beautiful base with a beautiful inscription. And it I think that it's also accessible. Wanted this to be something that anybody could touch, children, handicapped, anybody can come in and still touch it. In fact, I guess we're all hoping that the color rubs off of it one day, because it will be loved and the dog will be petted.
Sure.
And, you know.
I imagine many a bowl would be placed there.
Yes, and all the monuments I've done, I've seen how animals really bring us together. And actually, that's why I thought up of this monument that I'll be doing. It's called the National Service Animals Monument. It'll be the first one of its kind in the world, and it'll honor all of our service animals and their handlers since the founding of our country, whether in the military, law enforcement, whether search and rescue, assistance dogs, guide dog pairs for civilians and for our veterans. And this will tell the story about the great sacrifice, the great service, be inspiring, also very inspiring. It ties in with the pledge.
Sure.
It really tells the story. So that's something I'm excited about as well. And it continues the story. And so does the Purple Poppy movement. I should bring that up, because I brought the symbol of the purple poppy to the United States, and where the red poppy represents our service people who have made the ultimate sacrifice. Mm. In other countries, it's for the animals, and I brought it here to sort of do what the monument does, cover all our kinds of service animals and all their handlers and honor them. And so the Purple Poppy movement is tied in with it. So I hope your listeners will look into that and be a part of this as well. And I hope they'll visit the pledge, because that's the first monument in our nation's capital, as I said, not to honor our military women, all of them, but it's also the first one in the country to honor all our female military working dog handlers and their dogs.
Long, long overdue, Susan Bahari.
Yes, thank you.
Wow. So I imagine that you're just doing cartwheels, the creative process and the actual production process, and this is coming full circle, and this is the crescendo for you this Saturday. And then you're going to be streaming it on Facebook, correct?
Yes, it will be on Facebook for sure.
Under your Susan Bahari Studios?
Yeah, under Bahari Studios, Bahary Studios, and also the Women's Memorial at 2:00 on Saturday Eastern.
And please do check out Susan's complete line of work and her bio and more at Baharistudios.com, Baharistudios.com. Susan, all the best to you. And thank you so much for what you've done for this country throughout the years, and not limited to this Saturday's unveiling of the pledge, which really showcases the fervent and the vital, vital positioning and role of women in the military, past, present, and future.
Well, thank you for caring about artists.
Always, I love artists.
And thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. It's truly my honor and privilege to be part of all this.
Susan, all the best to you. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. My next guest is doing something very similar in life. She's pointing out the strength of women. And Jane Ward is a professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of California, Riverside, where she teaches courses in feminist, queer, and heterosexuality studies. Her new book, The Tragedy of Heterosexuality, is very, very compelling. And it's my pleasure to welcome Jane Ward to the show. Jane, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Are you on the West Coast?
I am, yeah.
Currently, I wasn't sure if you were, you know, remotely teaching or not. How is it out there?
Well, you know, the smoke has finally cleared from Southern California, so we're really grateful for that. It got to be so bad where we live that it had basically, we couldn't keep it out of our house. So I'm just,
my heart breaks, Jane.
Grateful every day for the firefighters and that
absolutely
we're breathing clean air.
Yeah, yeah. If we could only get people to sweep the forest floor now.
Yeah, or just, you know, do something about climate change.
Yeah, you know, that would be nice. That would be nice. So society a lot of times overlooks the constraints and the miseries of straight culture, because it is something that's oversold. What's your input on that?
Oh, I have so much to say.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, that's what the book is about.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I was motivated to write this book. It might seem a little odd since I am not a straight person. I am a lesbian, but I, you know, my wife and I, we've been together for 15 years. We have a 10-year-old son. And so
congratulations.
Thank you. And so that means that we hang out with a lot of straight couples because
my condolences.
Yeah, we meet them through you know, our child school and all of that, and so actually more of our friends these days that we see on a regular basis are straight. And you know, I'm in my 40s, and one of the things that I started to notice, aside from the fact that many of my straight friends were getting divorced and that many of those divorces were initiated by women, was that straight women spend a lot of time complaining about their husbands and or their boyfriends. And they seemed to me from the outside to seem kind of generally miserable. And a lot of their complaints were about inequalities that we have, as feminist researchers, we've known about for a long time, the unequal division of household labor, parenting labor, the emotional labor that you have to do in a family, and just feeling like they were really tired, burnt out on that inequality. And so I that raised the question for me, like, what's going on here that in many ways, you know, we're all taught that heterosexuality is the gold standard for love and that it's going to deliver happiness. And this starts at such a young age with Disney movies and all of that. And yet there, it, I think for many women in particular, it really doesn't live up to its promises. And that's really in contrast with my experience as a queer person, where the story in a lot of ways is the opposite, which is that, you know, when you come out to your parents, they're really worried about you, that you're going to have this miserable life full of discrimination and you won't have a family.
Who are the constant struggle, acceptance.
Right, right. And in fact, my experience as a queer person is just, you know, so much relief and joy and beauty.
Great.
Around being queer. So that kind of, those contradictions are what motivated me to write the book.
Well, you know, another misconception is that, you know, we all think it's easier. Well, a lot of society thinks it's easier to be straight. And now when you were mentioning about listening to all your straight friends, hopefully some of them don't gripe because some of them, love is love. That's my definition of love. I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's like, we have an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old, man can man love a man, women can love a man, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't matter. Love is love. But yeah, when you talk about hearing like people unhappy, do you think it's just a sheer imbalance of numbers of heterosexuals, dominating marriage versus, gay marriage, just as not, obviously the numbers are just so less. And so the stories of unhappiness are so much more prevalent.
I don't think so. The reason I don't think that is because we actually have a lot of research on this. We know many of the differences between heterosexual marriages, and I'm going to focus on lesbian marriages because really this book is about straight women primarily and about their experience of heterosexuality. Men have a lot more to gain from marriage than women do. So we know what's going on, and we know that it's quite different from what's happening in lesbian relationships. We know, for instance, that in lesbian relationships, all of that parenting and house cleaning and all of that work is divided much more equally. And that when that happens, that creates for a healthier and more harmonious marriage.
Sure.
We know that lesbians, I mean, I'm just really going to get into it, that women in relationships with women have more orgasms. So we also know that
makes me very jealous.
Yeah, right. It means that, you know, straight women often are not having very fulfilling sex lives.
Sure.
So So I would say, you know, it's not just that there are more straight people, so therefore we hear more of these sad stories. It's that there are really some dysfunctions that are built into so many heterosexual relationships. Now, they're not fixed. They're not unchangeable. And they're, so that's, you know, why I wrote this book, is I'm actually quite hopeful about how straight people can change their relationships, in part because I do know straight couples that have healthy relationships. And the key in those relationships is that the men are really committed to being feminist men. And when that happens, that changes everything.
I concur. I have to say that my mother is a feminist. I have three sisters. They are incredibly independent, successful. None of them have taken their husband's names. A menacist. I'm a man feminist.
Yes. Something about menacist.
Very true, because it's exactly what you bring to the table.
What was that?
And it's what you bring to the table, your perspective of what I expect to be as a 50% partner in this relationship. I grew up in a very nuclear household where my father was a breadwinner for most of it. And then my mother became a nurse and RN. But then it got divorced at a very, when I was young, but then I saw a different life. My father was a great man. It's just, he was a product of the generation. I guess I could say that as well, that I'm a slight product of the generation that has a bit more open eyes and understanding and compassion and, you know, erase the division and cultural lines and sexual lines and boundaries in a relationship.
You know, it's so great that you point out being a product of your generation, and your father being a product of his generation, because one of the things that I found in my historical research is a chapter of this book that is based on archival research I did on marriage advice manuals. And I wanted to go back to the very beginning of the self-help industry. You know, so much of that industry is about writing books that are mostly bought and read by women to help women save their marriages. And feel sexier, which is just connected. You know, it's one strategy for saving the marriage often. And these books started to be written in the early 20th century. There was a big boom from 1910 to 1930 in these what were then called marital hygiene books. And, you know, part of what I found was that for decades in the earliest self-help books for straight couples, just took as given that marriage was really horrific for women. It was a site of tremendous violence that most women, according to many of these authors who were like family physicians and so forth, were raped by their husbands on their wedding night. And that really set a tone for a lot of violence and misery for women who then didn't actually want to have sex with their husbands, were often kind of repulsed by their husbands. Sure. And so, you know, part of what I'm arguing in this book is that in the same way that you can't have four centuries of white supremacy and then snap your fingers and hope that racism is gone, you also can't have centuries of patriarchy in which women were basically slaves and property to their husbands and then think that that's completely healed. I think in many ways, straight couples are still in a healing process and in a kind of a process of really grappling with what are some of the legacies of those many centuries of men's violence and control of women, and how does that affect straight relationships? And I believe that it's not until men in particular, straight men in particular, are actually willing to think about that, to acknowledge that, to be honest with themselves, you know, that we're really going to heal that.
And how do we do this besides having your book delivered via Amazon to every man in the country?
Exactly. Well, that's of course the first step. What I offer is that there are other models out there, and I hope that straight men would be really into them. And the model I'm offering is how lesbians love women and have sex with women and lust for women, because I think within lesbian subculture, there's a understanding that when you're attracted to women, you're not just attracted to, like, you know, an individual woman. You, because you're so oriented to women, because you love women so much, you want what's best for women as a group. You care about women collectively. Mm. You care about their freedom, their self-determination, their equality, their rights. And that's totally interconnected with your sexual desire for women. And I think that link has been, for some reason, but because of patriarchy, really severed for a lot of straight men. So they're sexually attracted to women, but they don't think that's a really, like, individualized thing for them. They don't think of that as connected to wanting what's best for women as a group. And so I offer several suggestions for how straight men could become even more heterosexual, by which I mean be so into women, like women so much, lust for women so much, that they actually really like women.
Imagine that.
I know.
Wow. I guess it's easier said than done.
Yeah. I mean, it requires, in the same way that for white people grappling with the legacies of racism, it requires that men need to have some kind of, some basic education around these issues and also have an openness, you know. But I think one thing that I would say to men who are sort of like, this just sounds like, I don't know what they might say, feminazi propaganda, is that when men are feminists, one thing we know is that it actually makes their lives better. So, you know, they have better relationships with women. They have better sex with women. I mean, do you want to have sex with somebody who is faking orgasms and lying to you about her experience? Or do you actually want to be having really great sex with women?
Yeah. And who's more than there just physically?
Right. So I think, you know, men have a lot to gain from letting go of a lot of the toxic masculinity baggage. I mean, we know also that men are, far less likely to seek out therapy. They repress a lot of their feelings. This is why men die earlier. This is why men often have higher rates of addiction than women. And these things show up in heterosexual marriages. There's one great feminist writer who called men emotional gold diggers. Or she basically said, you know, because men don't tend to have really close friendships with other men and because they don't go to therapy, they turn to their spouse for all of their emotional needs to be met. And that burns women out, you know? And so I think part of what we're hoping for here is for men to just do a lot of healing, not just for women's sake, but for their own.
Absolutely. And I just picture, like, a New Yorker cartoon in my head, a man sitting on a therapist's couch saying, "Help me become a feminist."
Yes. Right. Well, I know
it's true. It's
psychoanalysts can do that.
Yeah. I think deeply rooted in the environment of which every man and boy is, you know, accustomed to and what they are exposed to. Because when I try to think about the hatred that's so omnipresent nowadays, I hope it's not as omnipresent as I think it is, but the hatred, the aggression, the racism and sexism. And I think about how I grew up and how I grew up in an open family. There were racists in our family, but they were openly discussed and we knew it and we knew it was wrong, et cetera. But I think about people who aren't in situations like that and have ignorance that are that could be their parents or their siblings, et cetera, and don't have people in their lives that point out that this is wrong. And I feel that that's why it's society's responsibility to be a model. And it would be nice if it went all the way up to the executive branch, the POTUS. And so we had men of power, men of compassion, men that were feminist.
Right. I know. I was writing this book During the last presidential election.
Is this the Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men?
No, this book.
Diversity, the Culture, and LGBT Activist Organizations?
No, that's another book.
Another one.
This is my third book. And this book, The Tragedy of Heterosexuality, I was writing, you know, as Trump got elected. And I, you know, I think I couldn't actually have written this book without Trump being in office, to tell you the truth, because for a long time, when we talked about misogyny, people would roll their eyes and be like, that's a thing of the past. That doesn't exist
far anymore. From
right. And Trump's behavior and his it's not just that his misogyny isn't subtle. He feels a lot of entitlement to express it. And so I think the fact that the president of the United States had said such vile things about women and promoted basically, you know, sexual harassment and sexual assault of women and bragged about his own actions in that regard made it really possible for people to pick up this book and be like, yeah, that's right. We're still dealing with this.
I think so. And I think it's, it gives people the permission to hate and to suppress and to just be everything that they think and they thought society wouldn't allow them, now that I have permission.
Right. It certainly normalizes it when you can say all of those things and do those things and still be elected to the highest office.
Jane Ward, I really, really hate saying this, but we are almost out of time.
Oh.
Yes, I have to have you back for a full-fledged proper interview because I have about a million and one things to ask you as well, and more on this. But what would you say to women in closing quickly? How can they be happier if they're in a straight marriage, heterosexual marriage, before they read your book and after they read your book, The Tragedy of Heterosexuality, to make life more compelling, more satisfying if their husband is not a feminist?
I think they could actually take a cue from men and be a little more entitled. And by that, I mean, I think women could be entitled to happiness.
I love that.
Yep.
And that's pretty, it sounds easy and some practice and get some support from your friends. And I imagine there are groups online.
Oh yeah. And also know that like sometimes I'm going to say something controversial, but sometimes divorce is really the best thing.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with starting over. You know, mistakes right. happen in every aspect of life.
Right. Exactly.
People change and you change and they change. And that can happen in any relationship.
Absolutely.
Gay, straight, or all the above.
Yes.
The Tragedy of Heterosexuality is available where, Jane Ward?
Oh, I hope you get it at your local bookstore, but you can get it from NYU Press. And of course, it is on Amazon.
And how do people follow Jane Ward?
I'm at janewardphd.com, or you can find me on Twitter. I tweet at The Queer Jane.
Queer Jane. I love it. Are you on Facebook as well? I couldn't find you.
I am. Yeah, I am.
Under?
Jane Ward.
Jane Ward. Well, I'm visually impaired, so maybe I missed you.
Okay. Well, I'll find you.
Yes, please do. Mark Farrell. Jane, all the best. And thank you for being honest. Thank you for being who you are and for forging ahead, blazing trails, whether you're accepted or not, because obviously you're doing what you want in life. You're impacting lives. You're in a healthy relationship. You've created a product of love. How old is your son?
10.
10. That's fantastic. Kudos to you. All the best to you.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
And keep enlightening America's future in your classes.
I will. Well, I'll try.
Absolutely. All the best. Jane, all the best to you. My name is Mark Farrell. This has been Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Knoll's next. Have a great day.